The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have a prodigio!
Swangled in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault?
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Rockfin, Rumble, Band.video, Vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks a million. We appreciate it. We've got a new website, macroaggressions.io. Go check it out. See what you think. Big thanks to our sponsors. They make this show happen. EMP Shield is building a device that will protect your home, your car, your boat and RV if you've got one, a generator if you've got one of those. It'll protect it against EMP strikes, lightning strikes, solar flares. These things happen. Hopefully the EMP doesn't happen, but my God, we've got Joe Biden in charge of us right now, so I'd say anything is on the table. This thing is, the device is many times more efficient than a single-use military design. It's built to handle 40 EMP strikes. If you were to face them, it's fitted to your household circuit breaker with just four wires. It installs like a type 2 surge protector. It's pretty easy to do. You can find the installation videos online on their website or wherever you go for videos. You can do it yourself or just have an electrician come out. So do this. Go to the website, read up about it. EMPShield.com is the place to go. The promo code is macro. And since we're in the beginning of the new year, Chemical Free Body is going to help you with your quest to get yourself healthy. This doesn't need to be relegated to a New Year's resolution type thing. You should be thinking about this at all times. But if you've decided that 2024 is the year that you're going to take control of your health, well, Chemical Free Body can help you by providing you with supplements that actually work. You could start yourself off with the detox bundle. I would do that. That's a 90-day program. It's drinking the green 85 drink every morning like I do and just eating a handful of capsules. Toxin detox, gut detox, ultra enzymes, probiotics. They come in capsule form. You just pop them. You're done in 5 minutes every day. I've done the program twice. I had such amazing results that I had to buy new shorts because I lost a lot of weight and I am a skinny person to begin with. I don't really have weight to lose. So if it did that to me, it stands to reason it could do something similar to you. Want to check it out? Go to chemicalfreebody.com and use the promo code macro to save yourself a little bit of money. He's back, everybody. Ryder Lee. Good to see you. He's the director of JFKX and Raised by Giants, host of that podcast. Go check it out. He's back. He's badder than ever. And we're going to talk UFOs. Ryder Lee, good to see you, man. How are you?
Good to see you, Charlie. Thanks so much for having me on. And we're going to be doing an amazing UFO show. I know you don't get to do too many UFO shows, but I think it's important to dig back into the history of the subjects. And we have let UFOs and extraterrestrial speculation grow so far out of hand, Charlie, that I personally believe that it serves to make people easily fooled by scammers, grifters, and fraudsters that bring zero evidence or zero proof of accusations or assertions. This, in turn, could mean that any group or individual, government or military, could use the modern myth of UFOs and extraterrestrials that may be bent upon the destruction and undermining of our society through deceptiveness, through mis and disinformation surrounding ufology. And this current contactee movement that started with a gentleman named Samuel Eden Thompson in 1950, that no one talks about because they've never even heard of him, because his story was overshadowed by Kenneth Arnold's sightings in 1947 and later on Betty and Barney Hill in 1961. Just like no one really talks about George Van Tassel, who was the first person to claim contact and channel Ashtar in 1952, or George King from the Aetherius Society, or Dorothy Martin from the Seekers UFO cult in 1954. But this supposed contactee movement has brought about a wave of what can only be described as mental illness that can be specifically tied to the rise in the popularization of extraterrestrial and UFO myths, which is a huge aspect of ufology that literally no one wants to talk about. And it's a very huge issue. So thanks so much for having me on, Charlie.
Well, thanks for coming on. I don't talk about UFOs, but it's not because I don't like the subject. I love it. I just don't bring anything to the table that's of particular importance. I mean, I love the topics. I love to geek out on it. I do like it when the military and the government converge over it in those ways. I love Dark Journalist. I watch his ex-steganography report and talk about how, you know, a lot of how the process gets buried under bureaucracy, but it's had a real resurgence lately. We had aliens in the Miami Mall earlier this year. You know what I mean?
But were they extraterrestrial aliens or were they illegal aliens? That's a different story.
We have those too. Those are always in the Miami Mall. But we had 10 footers that came in. So it feels, so it's like on the one hand, I have a true interest in this. I'd love to know what's going on. I'm interested. I don't know the sorts of people that have the answers, but I'm curious about it and I want to know more about it. I do recognize it as an industry that is ripe for disinformation, misinformation. It's easy to make people look crazy. And on top of that, a lot of crazy people get into this line of work because they like talking about this stuff. And so it is definitely difficult to separate the people that are just maybe like just clearly not right, and then the people that mean well but are wrong, and then you've got another group that maybe are disinformation agents. And of course, when you come from the U.S. government and you've got this training on how to deflect and how to give 95% truth and 5% lie, and you know how to set up somebody and make them believe that they're getting good information when in fact you maybe have poisoned the well, and that might have been the case with somebody like Bob Lazar, where, you know, it's like, well, is he telling the truth? Yes or no? It's like, well, he believes he's telling the truth, but is it actually the truth? He read something and then he went and talked about it. Was he meant to see that? Was he meant to read that? And then did they know psychologically by doing the profiles on him that he's the type of guy that eventually would talk about it? I mean, was this a setup? And so I recognize that there are all of these traps laid everywhere, and I don't have any particular I don't know what's what necessarily on a lot of this stuff. So, let's start from the beginning, like you said. I mean, because it's popular now and it's trendy and everyone's kind of talking about it. But if we don't understand the history of it, then I think we're probably at a disadvantage. So I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're here to give us the backstory on Kenneth Arnold and talk about that, and Benny and Barty Hill, and talk about Paul Benowitz, and talk about some of these stories and some of these names that are recognizable, but maybe we don't know all the details of it. So fill us in and start wherever you want with where this UFO story really got going.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Yeah. See, it's my belief, Charlie, that human actions are based on imagination, right? Imagination, belief, and faith, and not on objective observation. And I'm pretty sure the government, the military, and politicians know this as well. You can pretty much track back everything to emotion and fear. And then the question becomes, well, can we control human imagination? Can we shape and mold the world's collective destiny? And if so, how do we do this? Well, how you do it is by making sure that the source of the control is never identifiable by the public. And then you can effectively prepare the public for unavoidable changes and push the collective mind in the desirable direction that you want it to go. And that's why it's important that these intelligence agencies and advertising companies are very interested in mythology and things that may or may not be true, because it can be used to shape and mold the collective consciousness. This is why we see the rise in the contactee community and ufology as a whole, which is used to play with our imagination, which to me represents experiments in the direction of weaponized folklore, rising superstition, mental illness, and paranoia. Now, the very first modern flying saucer sighting was by Kenneth Arnold. And that was in 1947. Here is a picture, if you're watching the video version of the show, of Kenneth Arnold. But that's not where the phenomenon starts, right? It tracks way back thousands of years, but they weren't called UFOs or flying saucers back then. They were called shields, pillars, or flying chariots, right? I'm just saying that because I realize that the history of this stuff, right, is just because I don't mention it doesn't mean that I don't know about it. And I can see someone now, right, in the comments saying, oh, well, it goes back way farther than 1947, which it does, but they weren't called flying saucers back then. Kenneth Arnold kicked off the term flying saucers. But did he? Right? And this is the research that really people do not want to get into. So for the people that aren't familiar with Kenneth Arnold, he was a very well-respected aviator, businessman, and later on a politician. He was the first person in modern times to witness and report a strange craft in the sky. At approximately 3 p.m. on June 24th, 1947, Kenneth Arnold was piloting his A-2 plane in the skies near Mount Rainier, Washington. He was searching for missing Marine aircraft and witnessed a string of 9 objects at 10,000 feet. They flew at amazing speeds of what Arnold estimated at 1,500 miles an hour. He said that the objects lacked tails and reflected sunlight. Now, after witnessing these craft, he landed his plane in Yakima, Washington, and told his friend Al Baxter about the sighting. Arnold then shared his story with other pilots, and he said that these other pilots made the comment that maybe what he saw was military aircraft or military missiles. Now, Arnold, not being satisfied with this explanation from other pilots and his friends, not being convinced by these explanations of what he saw, the next day he walked into a local news station and told his story to a gentleman named Nolan Skiff. Nolan Skiff published a short article with the headline that said, "Impossible, maybe, but seeing is believing." Then that story was forwarded to the Associated Press for worldwide distribution, and the term flying saucer was born. Now, it's important in the beginning to realize that Kenneth Arnold was pretty reserved about his account of the craft that he witnessed, but the story progressed and public interest became so popular that it turned into a gigantic media frenzy. Now, when you look at Arnold's testimony, which he did a lot of interviews and a lot of radio shows, he never used the term flying saucer to describe the shape of the craft. He said that it was bat-shaped, crescent-shaped, boomerang-shaped, and he often said that his comments on his sightings were misunderstood. And he ended up working very hard up into the end of his life in 1984 to combat the flying saucer narrative. So the sketches, which I'm going to show a picture of the sketches here in a minute, that Kenneth Arnold drew to describe what he saw doesn't even come close to the commonly accepted version of what UFOs are. Now, what had happened was Nolan Skiff, the journalist that published Arnold's story in the newspaper, said that Arnold had sighted nine saucer-like aircraft. The media took the saucer-like aircraft and ran with it and created headlines saying, saucer-shaped craft was spotted, when, again, Arnold literally never referred to the shape of the craft as saucer-shaped. It was bat-shaped, crescent-shaped, half-moon-shaped, and sometimes he would say that they were shaped like a pie plate or a pie pan. In an interview with Arnold by the United Press, he said that they were half moon-shaped, oval in the front with a convex in the back. So on June 1947, Arnold finally came out with the drawing of the craft. And this is a picture of the drawing of the craft.
Well, that doesn't look like a saucer at all. It looks like this stealth bomber.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Here's another picture of it that doesn't have Arnold in it, so you can get a better idea of what it looks like. Right? And boom, it looks nothing like what people think that a flying saucer looks like. It's bat-shaped, it's circular, it's winged in the back. And you'd think with Arnold coming out with this drawing of the craft, it would stop all of the talks of discs and flying saucers, but it didn't. So this became such a big frenzy topic with everyone reporting strange craft now, right? It's just like Whitley Strieber with the gray aliens. It's just like Bud Hopkins with the missing time. As soon as those books and stuff came out, everyone started experiencing them. And Arnold had a quote that he said, talking about what other people were witnessing. He said that other eyewitnesses that are reporting strange craft are something else. They're not what he witnessed, or they're nothing at all. Right? Arnold was pretty much telling people back in 1947 that they're making shit up. Right?
Sure. At least you know the media is consistent in their lying. It's been 77 years and they're still lying, so nothing has really changed, I suppose.
Yep. And there was another quote from Arnold during an interview that he said that he feels that it should be labeled a strange type of aircraft instead of flying saucers. So on April 7th of 1950, Arnold spills the beans. He comes out and talks about the misrepresentation and the misquote that the reporters got wrong. He said that the objects that he witnessed fluttered like they were on boats on very rough water. And this next part is very important because this is where the misquote really came in. He said when the craft flew, they flew like a saucer thrown across the water. And all of the newspapers misunderstood that quote and misquoted him saying that they flew like the shape of the craft was saucer in shape.
Right. Okay.
They misquoted that entire thing for the shape of the craft when Arnold said that they flew like a saucer skipping across water. And the headline said that it was saucer in shape, which is probably the biggest misquote of all time, right?
Yeah.
Later on, Arnold, you know, changed his thoughts and his ideas about what they were. He went into calling them jellyfish, and that they could change shape and morph into whatever you wanted to see, and related it to the Bible and the Book of Ezekiel, which he was more than likely the first person to do that. I'm pretty sure he started saying that in 1952, which then kicked off all of the Book of Ezekiel UFO stuff that Ancient Aliens loves so much, and Eric Von Daniken as well. Now, this is the part that is very perplexing to people, and you're going to love this, Charlie, and I think a lot of other people are going to love it. And whenever I first found out about this, it's from, I wish I had his book here. I should have had his book so I could show you, but it's from a book titled Saucers by Chris Albeck. You can purchase it on Amazon Prime. I've had him on my show a few times, but this was very perplexing to me, and still I kind of really don't know what to make of it, but I'm very interested to hear what you think about this. Now we get into the term of what flying saucers actually was before it was associated with UFOs. Flying saucers was a sport that predated Arnold's sighting by over 60 years, which was called trap shooting, which was started in the late 1800s as a way to train hunters and shooters, in which they would release live birds from a cage and use them as target practice, and later was changed to these little clay pigeons, these flat disc. Hold on, I got a picture that I'll show you really quick. So these are the what is now commonly known as clay pigeons, but before they were clay pigeons, they were called flying saucers because of their shape. And this started with a man named Charles Lewitsky in 1880, and he dubbed these little clay pigeons flying saucers. So by the early 1900s, flying saucers, clay pigeons, had become a very popular sport. There were competitions, championships, and there was news headlines in North America saying the North American skies are covered in flying saucers flying through the air and exploding and falling to Earth. Right. Which is the exact replica of the phrases that everyone thought several decades later with Kenneth Arnold's sighting. Right. The Roswell incident and all the sightings in the 50s. Just a coincidence, right? So by the 20th century, the name flying saucer had become a commonplace name being used for over two decades. The sport of flying saucers had become so popular, it was adopted by the Olympics in 1916, and the number of participants in the sport of flying saucers was 600,000 people in the U.S. All of those people knew the term flying saucers and called these clay pigeons flying saucers. It was so popular, the military even adopted it to train their soldiers in target practice in the beginning of World War II. You have to put that one together right there. As war permeated, trap shooting started to die off with people losing interest in it with the public. And a press statement came out, which I am going to read off right here. It says, "Your Uncle Sam has sounded the call to all of you sportsmen who have 12-gauge shotguns to hand them over to him so that the boys in the Air Corps can sharpen up on their wing shooting. The shotguns will be used by the young aerial gunners to smash the flying clay saucers on skeet shooting and trap plants to the various training corps." So we have the military basically coming in and taking the sport of trap shooting, which they were called flying saucers, and using it for their purpose, which seems to be what has happened nowadays with disclosure. It's been like a military and a three-letter organization takeover. So we have these clay pigeons being called flying saucers since 1880. Hundreds and thousands of people being familiar with the term. The military adopted the term and the practice in the early 40s during World War II. 2 years after the war ended, we get the term flying saucer, but under a different context. It's wild, and I'm really perplexed by it as well. So what we have is that the entire subject of ufology is based on a fallacy. And ufology has been using the shape of a round disc when it was never described by Arnold as a disc or a flying saucer. So we've literally had the shape wrong this entire time. For 77 years, we've essentially been telling and regurgitating a misrepresentation of what Arnold said he saw. And out of Arnold's own words, what other claims other people were claiming at the time to have seen wasn't the same, or it was nothing at all. And I challenge anyone to find a quote from Arnold that the shape of the craft was saucer-like, not what other people quoted him as saying, because they obviously got it wrong and misinterpreted his words, but find a quote of Arnold himself saying that the craft that he witnessed on June 24th, 1947 was a flying saucer. You can't, because it doesn't exist.
Was he obviously a pilot, but was he a pilot? I'm assuming back then if you wanted to become a pilot, you were usually trained by the military. Was he ex-military?
I don't believe so. I believe he was a private pilot that just had his own type of plane, kind of like Harrison Ford. You remember when Harrison Ford wrecked his his airplane or whatever, and people thought that he died?
Yeah. My dad was a pilot, and he didn't learn to fly in the military too. So I know it happens. I was just curious, because when you said, you know, not that time, that era, there were a lot of people that, whether they wanted to be in the military or not, they were in it and they were getting out, and they had skills like flying planes, skills like, you know, all kinds of things. But, there is a history of the term flying saucer. It is disconnected from anything supernatural and anything that has to do with aircraft. It does fly through the sky. I know what skeet shooting is. I understand this. I've seen those things for a long, long time, and they are saucer-like, and they are flying. And it would make sense to call them a flying saucer. You wouldn't probably call them that nowadays, because the term would evoke UFOs. But back then, before there was any sort of connection to that, that's a reasonable thing to call them. And that would explain why that was sort of in that concept of flying saucers as a term was in the public consciousness on some level, because there's a term for that. Now, he's very clear about it not being saucer shaped and it looking like a bat or a wing or something like that. I don't think he's the only person. It feels like I've heard other people from maybe that era talk about something similar. Are we not, considering he's talking about it then, and then 40, 50 years later, we wind up with the B-2 stealth bomber technology, and we see some of those old German drawings of the flying wing that the Nazis were working on. We have Operation Paperclip. Is it reasonable to think that maybe what he saw was some sort of not well known military technology that was just flying in formation that he would have not been privy to, that it would have most definitely looked like a fleet of unidentified flying objects that were flying a lot faster than normal? I mean, is it possible that this was just like the secret technology coming out of the Pacific Northwest in an area, I don't know, near where Boeing flies their stuff?
That's right. And I think that Sean Kirkpatrick just came out, which he was the head of Aero, the government program to investigate UFOs. He retired from being the head of Arrow last year. And he came out in an article and said that almost all of the sightings since the late 40s have been due to military craft that people aren't privy to, or R&D type of things. And this is what I've been trying to really get across to people, that, and we're going to get into that with the Paul Benowitz story, because that's exactly what happened to Paul Benowitz, and the government mis and disinformation that was fed directly to Paul Benowitz when he was seeing military craft, and they came in and convinced him that it was extraterrestrial craft. It basically drove him crazy. But the flying saucer mythology is a lie. It's a fallacy. It's a misnomer. It's misinterpreted, quote, from news reporters, journalists, and researchers. And it is still the most popular symbol of ufology to this very day. Even though it's not called flying saucers so much anymore, flying saucers are the basis and the root of modern ufology. Every conference, every UFO documentary, YouTube thumbnails use the flying saucer art when it's a lie. That's never been what they've looked like. Now, you'll find quotes from Arnold saying that the craft was bat-shaped, boomerang-shaped, shaped like a pie pan. Never once did he say that the shape of the craft was saucer. Never said that it was saucer-shaped. He didn't say it. And he said that the way that the craft moved was like a saucer across water, skipping across water, not the shape of the craft, which is just a coincidence that George Lewitsky, the gentleman that created the term flying saucer as the clay pigeons in 1880, also said the exact same thing with coming up with the idea of the sport of flying saucers in 1880. 67 years before Kenneth Arnold, George Lewitsky said that he got the idea of using clay pigeons for trap shooting, which was called flying saucers, from watching kids toss saucers across water.
Whoa. That's interesting. So they want you to think it's one shape when it's really another. That's classic disinformation, right? A tactic that the military and the media have been using for a long, long time. So it makes me think that whatever Kenneth Arnold saw in the shape that he saw it, it's probably his description is definitely going to be more believable to me than the media and the government sort of nodding along going, oh, no, they're saucers. So when Paul Benowitz and these guys come along in the future, what's their take on the shape? Do they get into this? Does this dominate what they talk about with regard to what they saw out there on the night? And when did Paul Benowitz see it? Late 70s?
79. Well, you have the Roswell event also in that same year of Kenneth Arnold's sightings that say that a flying saucer has crashed in some of the news headlines. And then you have flying saucers reported over the Washington, D.C., over the White House in 1952, the Washington Flap event. So it's been regurgitated in the shape from that Kenneth Arnold never really described has been turned into something that it's not and has been permeated throughout the decades. But Paul Frederick Benowitz Jr. is his full name. He was a American businessman and a UFO investigator. Here is a picture of him for people that are watching the video version of the show. Benowitz was born in Kansas. He earned a bachelor's degree from Arizona State. And during World War II, Benowitz was a radio electronics engineer for the Coast Guard. He was a World War II veteran. He was in the military. He worked as an engineer for San Francisco CBS station and a radio station in Tucson. On February 1949, Binowitz married Cindy Brunch in Phoenix, Arizona. Around 1953, Binowitz moved to New Mexico and started working in sales. Binowitz later began his own industrial sales company in 1966. Binowitz acquired the rights to a humidity sensor from Sedona National Laboratories. He founded his own company named Thunder Scientific, which was a small family business with his wife, Cindy, and they developed high-powered instruments for NASA and the Air Force. So during the 70s, Binowitz became a member of the Arizona Aerial Phenomenon Research Organization, which was a civilian UFO investigation group. So by the mid-70s, cattle mutilations were really on the rise, and then cattle mutilations became associated with UFOs as an explanation of why this was happening to people's cattle. Excuse me. So on April 20th, 1979, U.S. Attorney R.E. Thompson and U.S. Senator Harrison Schmitt held a public meeting about cattle mutilations. The meeting was attended by around 80 people, and one of the attendees was Paul Binowitz. Now, some say at this meeting about cattle mutilations, this was where the targeting by government agencies likely first happened. Because at the meeting, Paul Binowitz was introduced to a highway patrol officer, Gabe Valdez, who was investigating the incidents, which is important for people to remember for later on when we get into that. So Binowitz later listed July 1979 as the beginning of a personally funded study into UFOs, because Binowitz reportedly began filming strange lights and recording unusual audio signals over Kirkland Air Force Base. So Paul Binowitz would post up on his back patio at his house, and Kirkland Air Force Base was only like a half a mile away. He could see these strange lights, mainly two bright lights. They would slowly lift up off of the ground, and then they would zip back and forth around the mountain. So common sense would tell you that if you're filming strange stuff over a military base, what would that be, right? It'd be the freaking military
stuff,
right?
That's,
yeah. It's like Jeremy Corbell taking a picture of some flares over a military base and calling them UFOs when they're proven to be flares, right? And if you're the military and a gentleman that is close to the military base is possibly in possession of video with top secret experimental craft and has recorded radio transmissions of top secret operations, what do you do, right? So Paul, being a radio expert, very well versed in radio technology, he decided to try and listen in to the communications at Kirkland Air Force Base to try and figure out what these strange lights were that he was seeing. So supposedly he decoded a bunch of the transmissions, and he had put it together on his own that it was about technology and that the technology wasn't from here. So this began his journey into the extraterrestrial realm. So in October of 1980, Binowitz contacted Kirkland Air Force Base to report his finding, like any good citizen would do. And at this point, on November of 1980, Binowitz briefed people at Kirkland Air Force Base on his findings. The military personnel possibly thought that maybe this could have been a Soviet threat or another country or someone planning to invade the base. So to figure out more about what Paul Binowitz knew and to make sure it wasn't a threat, they put him in contact with a man named Richard Doty. Richard Doty is an AFOSI, Air Force Office of Special Investigations. Paul, not really knowing what he had because he didn't analyze the recordings and the footage properly. Richard Doty figuring out pretty quickly after going to his house to speak with him that what he had was top secret radio transmissions from the Air Force Base and video footage of top secret craft that they were working on. Didn't have anything to do with extraterrestrials. But Richard Doty came in and convinced Paul that it was extraterrestrials. And it had to do with extraterrestrial craft. Now, he wasn't outright telling him that for a fact, but you know how mis- and disinformation works. You plant a seed, right? You come to him and be like, oh, that radio, those radio transmissions you got is could possibly come from extraterrestrials, yeah. Right? And UFOs. And with Paul being a World War II veteran, it was easy to convince him to keep quiet about it for a time. Like, you know, be quiet, Paul. You owe it to your country, brother, not to say anything about this. Don't show this footage. Don't let this radio transmissions get out. Keep all of this information to yourself. But it wasn't just Doty that was doing this. Richard Doty, I don't really put a lot of too much blame on Richard Doty for this because he was quite literally doing a job, right? That was his job to do that, to go out and spread mis- and disinformation about extraterrestrials and UFOs. But all of the generals during Paul Benowitz's briefing to the Air Force was in on it, right? After Paul showed them this footage he captured of the strange craft, which again was a top secret experimental craft, a brigadier general stood up and said, Paul, you got some pretty convincing evidence there, brother. And asked him, what would you like the Air Force to do about it? And Paul asked for a grant. He asked for a grant to continue to study UFOs on the base and a grant to continue his contact with aliens that he claimed that he had. Now, this is where it gets really sinister. Very sinister. We've established that the Air Force special investigators like Richard Doty and all the Air Force personnel were involved in that briefing and was pushing Paul in this direction of extraterrestrials and UFOs. When what he was really getting was video footage of top secret experimental craft and radio transmissions from the Air Force base. But another agency was also involved. What had happened was Paul was picking up these signals from Kirkland Air Force Base. He didn't really know that that was the case. So the NSA posted up across the street and would directly beam radio signals into Paul's antenna on top of his house to make Paul believe he was getting what he should be getting and seeing what they thought that he should be seeing. The NSA literally broke into Paul Benowitz's house, replaced his computer with an NSA-modified computer. The computer had software installed onto it to decode the messages that were being sent to Paul Benowitz's computer to display them in the way that they wanted Paul to see them.
Jesus. Holy shit. I hate our government so much. They're such fuckers. This poor bastard.
He is getting it from all angles. And these messages that Paul thought that he was receiving from extraterrestrials, which was really the freaking NSA, said that they were from a planet with no water, said that they were here for our resources to take over the Earth, and that they only trusted Paul because Paul was the chosen one, and all kinds of other stuff, which a lot of the things that were talked about with Paul Benowitz believing that he's in communication with extraterrestrials are still regurgitated in this community to this very day, when they're completely and utterly made up by NSA agents.
But to Paul's credit, he didn't know.
No.
Okay.
Wow. He did not know that he was being fed all this mis and disinformation, but it gets worse. God. If you think that was bad, it gets even worse. So in May of 1980, state police in New Mexico received a report from a woman calling herself Myrna Henson. She was describing a story involving extraterrestrial aliens, bright lights, and herds of cattle. Police then referred the case to their colleague in Duluth, Gabe Valdez, who they knew to be the cattle mutilation guy for his interest in the cases. Valdez, in turn, contacted Paul Benowitz, which where Paul Benowitz and Valdez met was at that cattle mutilation conference where they were first introduced. So on May 7th, 1980, Myrna Henson and her son traveled to Albuquerque to meet with Benowitz. Staying in his home, Henson explained to Benowitz that on May 5th, 1980, while she was driving with her son near Eagle Nest, New Mexico, they had witnessed two large silent objects approximately the size of a Goodyear blimp hovering over a meadow. Okay. If it looks like a Goodyear blimp, acts like a Goodyear blimp, then it's probably a Goodyear blimp. Okay.
Pretty much.
But anyway, they contacted a gentleman named Leo Sprinkle, a psychologist and a professor at the University of Wyoming who had been investigating UFO contactee reports. And Benowitz arranged for Sprinkle to fly to Albuquerque to hypnotize Henson. When Sprinkle arrived, Henson and Benowitz insisted that the sessions be conducted in Benowitz's Lincoln Town car parked inside of the family's garage with the car windows covered with thick aluminum foil.
Okay.
Paul's literally going out of his
mind. Tinfoil hat this wearing. He's freaking at this point.
And which I don't blame him, right? You got the NSA across the street beaming freaking frequencies and signals into your antenna, making you believe that you're communicating with extraterrestrials. You got the Air Force telling him that he's right about aliens, right? But you can't tell anyone. Mm-hmm. It would probably drive you out of your mind, right? Yeah. So Sprinkle decided to regress this woman in the tinfoiled out car in Paul Benowitz's garage. And during her first regression, she reported a recollection of a cow being sucked up into a hovering spaceship by a tractor beam. And then another one on May 11th, I think May 11th and 12th of 1980, under hypnosis, Henson reported recollections of an abduction and being taken to an underground base with body parts floating in vats. These regressions would later evolve into the mythology of the Duluth base and Phil Schneider. Mm-hmm. Phil Schneider basically completely popularized the whole idea of the big underground base. And also during this session, she said, "Where's Roswell, New Mexico?" Although no one in the public had yet connected the town of Roswell to UFO folklore yet, which was the perfect setup for Bill Moore's book on Roswell called The Roswell Incident, just a few months later in October of 1980, which was all mis and disinformation about alien craft in Roswell, which popularized the myth and the lore and brought that event in Roswell to the forefront of ufology. And Bill Moore, he gets up in front of the MUFON conference in 1989 and tries to tell everybody that it's fake and that it's made up, and he was fed all this mis and disinformation directly from Richard Doty, and they boo him off of the stage. All right, so Henson, along with claiming to see these large blimp-like craft, she also recalled having seen been given alien implants. Here comes the alien implant lore, right? Mm-hmm. So Sprinkle returned to visit Paul Benowitz to perform another regression on Henson to figure out more made-up nonsense. And he found Benowitz armed with a pistol and a rifle. Seeing that he was concerned that he was vulnerable to being attacked by aliens. These people were literally driving Paul out of his mind to the point where he was thinking that he was going to be attacked by aliens. It's honestly a very sad story. So Benowitz armed up with guns and tinfoil to protect himself and his family in Henson. So Paul, thinking that Sprinkle was an alien or whatever he thought, he told him to leave. But then he contacted another hypnotist by the name of James Harder. Now, James Harder had also conducted the hypnotic regression of Travis Walton
okay.
in 1975,
okay.
which is a whole other story that I will be covering in the future on my channel, Legends of Ufology series.
The movie but Fire Benowitz, in the Sky is based on that, yes. and Travis Walton's accounts being out in the woods in Oregon, I think, somewhere. Is that right?
Yes. And so Benowitz and James Harder, this gentleman that regressed, I just blanked on his name. Who did I just say? Travis Walton. Sorry. Had a brain fart there. The guy that had regressed, Travis Walton, came to the conclusion, him and Paul Benowitz came to the conclusion that Henson, this lady that was definitely a intelligence plant sent to Paul Benowitz, they came to the conclusion that Henson was under the influence of alien beams, alien tractor beams. And they wrote detailed instructions on how to use aluminum foil to shield a room from beams before conducting a regression. This is literally where all of the tinfoil hat stuff comes from, and no one has any idea that it came from government myths and disinformation surrounding Paul Benowitz, convincing him that what he was seeing was extraterrestrials when it was advanced military craft, and that he was in communication with extraterrestrial through his computer when it was really the NSA.
Watch it. We find out that the CIA owned like a front company that was making aluminum foil. So they're like, we'll make money on both ends here.
I can see it. I wouldn't put it past him. Right? So Gabriel Valdez's son later came out and commented about the Myrna Henson story, and he said that it was likely that it was an intelligence community set up because his dad's house was bugged with all these listening devices, and the government had heard all of the conversations on the phone between Valdez and Benowitz. So he concluded that it was a huge hoax. And it's hard to figure out anything about this Myrna Henson lady, because Myrna Henson is also the name of a famous actress and model who won Miss USA in 1953. So it's practically impossible to figure out who she was or figure out any information on it. But I'm willing to bet money that she was sent to Paul Benowitz by the intelligence community.
Yeah.
And that's a perfect cover too, because when you Google in Myrna Henson, all you're going to get is the actress and the model who won the Miss USA pageant in 1953.
Right.
But that's really not it, because we get into the full swing of this base and all the mythology and all the rumors and theories and speculation of the Duluth base. And it all started because of the information that was given to Paul Benowitz by government mis- and disinformation, Air Force Special Agents, NSA, and Myrna Henson. So in December of 1981, Paul Benowitz wrote a letter to the U.S. Senator explaining that he knew the location of an alien base in northern New Mexico that he knew someone in the military had made a deal with the aliens several years ago, giving them the land and the cattle and assurance of safety to the aliens in trade for technology in the form of an atomic-powered ship, and at the same time establishing an extensive U.S. base alongside to test this ship, and that the ship design traded for was over 30 years behind the alien technology, which is everything that people have regurgitated into this community for years and years and years. In 1984, Binowitz again referenced the 1979 conflict at the alien underground base that led to the closure of the alien human base, which was completely made up fiction, which would be later regurgitated by John Lear, Bill Cooper, and Phil Schneider. And now we know where all these stories come from. That's what Bill Cooper always talked about in the mid-80s, was a contract with the United States government and extraterrestrials for technology exchange. But Bill Cooper added that it was Eisenhower that made this contract and sealed the deal.
Right.
He just changed it up just slightly, right? And Phil Schneider is a whole other story, and I'm going to get into him on the show as well. But by 1982, Binowitz began contacting UFO researchers like Linda Moldenhau, John Lear, this U.S. Senator Harrison, and began to spread his ideas regarding this underground base to others in the ufology community. And boom, UFO mythology that came directly from the NSA, Air Force agents, and Myrna Henson was born, right? All of this is detailed in books between the Binowitz's relationship with the government. It was all put into a book called Clear Intent, Government Cover-Up of UFO Experience. The story, you know, spread rapidly within the UFO community. And in 1987, John Lear claimed that he had independent confirmations of the base's existence, which came directly from Paul Binowitz. George Clinton Andrews discussed the underground base legends in his book Extraterrestrials Among Us in 1988. The tabloid Weekly World News published a story entitled UFO Base Found in New Mexico, which claimed that a diabolical invaders from another solar system planet set up have come and set up a secret underground base in the mountains of northern New Mexico. So, and that they use humans as guinea pigs for genetic experiments. It's all bullshit. And in 1999, the Albuquerque Tribune featured a mention of Paul and Cindy's 50th anniversary. Paul Binowitz ended up dying on June 23rd, 2003. In 2005, the book Project Beta, the story of Paul Binowitz, national security and the creation of the modern UFO myth, by Mark Pilkington. The book also details that Project Beta, which was the mis- and disinformation surrounding Paul Binowitz. Also, a book called Mirage Men was published in 2010, and the book was then adapted into a documentary in 2013, also by the same name, Mirage Men, where former special agent of the Air Force Special Investigations, Richard Doty, claimed that in the 1980s, he was tasked with hoaxing documents and feeding false information to UFO researchers, including Linda Moldenhau, Bill Moore, and Paul Binowitz.
Wow. So we know that there's a lot of fuckery afoot here. It's a category that has always been thought of as, you know, a lot of very hard to prove a lot of this stuff. The people that do see things get demonized and laughed at and mocked and all that. It doesn't, you know, it's hard. It doesn't pay to be an experiencer. It doesn't pay to really have seen this stuff. You just get, unless you're on the verge of mental illness and you get something out or some sort of trip that you're looking for out of it. But if you want to just make money, and you will be ridiculed for a long, long time believing this stuff. But we know about these secretive groups from like the 50s, like MJ-12. What are they doing? What are they involved in? If they've got disinformation campaigns going on, and the government feels the need to deceive and point in one direction when something else might be going on elsewhere, then my assumption would be that they are covering up for something. Are they covering up actual military technology that they just don't want people to find out about? Are they covering up actual UFO technology that they also don't want people to know anything about?
Well, that's the thing. What would you do, Charlie, if it was extraterrestrials and aliens and extraterrestrial craft? Would you tell people that it's aliens, extraterrestrial craft?
I'd tell them it was military.
If you wanted, exactly. Now, if it's the military,
I'd tell them it was alien.
Boom. You just solved it. But when it comes to the MJ-12 stuff, the community is really split on MJ-12. Some people say the documents that were surrounding the MJ-12 documents are fake. Another half of the community says that it's real. It's just like the Wilson documents. It's just like a lot of the supposed UFO documents. Half the community thinks that it's real. Half the community thinks that it's fake. So there's really not any clear answers on that. And that really comes from the director of the Secretary of the Navy. I'm blanking on his name really quickly, but he was really good friends with JFK, and he became the first secretary.
Oh, McNamara.
Of the Navy.
No. Who? I said McNamara. I think that was, he became Secretary of Defense. I'm not sure who's running the Navy back then, but I do know that there was there's a huge push to get people. All of a sudden, it seemed like there was a push to kind of normalize UFOs, and it happened in the mainstream. It happened in books. It happened in over the radio, War of the Worlds, all of this. There became some sort of benefit to the media and the powers that be if the general public believed that there was a possibility of aliens invading and doing something to them. And it always makes me feel like, you know, that they have to have an external threat, something that they're going to defend us against. And as long as they can defend us against it, then they remain relevant and we need them. We get Wernher von Braun talking about, you know, the final card being the fake alien invasion. And, you know, when you hear that, first time you hear that, you go, oh, that sounds crazy. And then you get to where we are now and you start to see a lot of talk about it. It's starting to get normalized. We have the David Grushes of the world out there doing press conferences and talking about it. Stephen Greer is going on shows wherever he can. You know, as you mentioned, Jeremy Corbell getting on Rogan a lot, George Knapp. I mean, it's become a whole industry. And now it's like there's the UFO industry, and then there's the mainstream UFO, which is like you want to get on Ancient Aliens and talk about that stuff. There's that. Then there's the more of the hardcore geeky UFO guys that really get in the weeds and find these obscure documents that have been buried and nobody has. And I don't really even know where I stand with all of this stuff. I mean, I fully recognize that the government is capable of lying about all sorts of things. And I know that if there were UFOs, they would tell us that there were not. And if they're starting to tell us that there are UFOs, then I get the feeling that they're covering up for something else, because I don't believe them if they were to tell me what they had for breakfast. You know, these are not people that you trust under any circumstances. And guys, you know, coming out and saying, well, we have to do a UFO task force and we have to raise money. And John Brennan's talking about shit like this. You just go, wait a second. These are the last people in the world I would be believing about anything. If you're going to have Harry Reid comes out, you know, Harry Reid was a big advocate for this. They renamed the Vegas airport after him. I don't know when, you know, Last time I was there, it's no longer McCarran Airport. It's the Harry Reid Airport. So I guess if you keep the mm-hmm. the UFO situation under control and you do what you're told, maybe they'll name an airport after you. Are we looking at the, we're not looking at a Paul Benowitz airport anytime soon, are we? Are we?
I don't think so. And it was James Forrestal that was the first Secretary of the Navy.
So oh, yeah, and he got thrown out a window. Yeah.
Yes. But that's where a lot of the MJ-12 mythology and lore comes from, was from James Forrestal. Now, it's important that you brought up Project Paperclip. I believe that there's a huge missing piece here when it comes to Project Paperclip, because Russia officially got more Germans after World War II than the U.S. did. Yeah. Officially, is what I'm saying. Yeah, the Soviet operation, the Soviet Project Paperclip operation got more than 2,500 former Nazi German specialists were relocated to the Soviet Union, along with 4,000 family members, which were relocated as well, totaling in approximately 6,500 Germans relocated to Russia. And officially, this is official, I mean, the U.S. got 1,600, right, though some people say that the number is fictitious. It's supposedly closer to 10,000 range. But again, that's officially. But I bring that up because it's important, because people normally look over the fact that it wasn't just the United States that got these former Nazi engineers. And people try to play off that Russia only got some of the woo-woo people. They didn't. They got some of the exact same type of people, and they got them first. So people don't really realize, because it doesn't get mentioned, and they blow off Russia as like woo-woo, and that Russia got all these woo-woo people, like metaphysical and occult and esoteric people, which they also probably got some of those as well. But Russia's goal was literally to transplant and research the research and the production research centers, such as the V2 Rocket Center of Germany, into the Soviet Union, and get as much material as possible, like the Luftwaffe Central Military Aviation Test Center, which was taken by the Russian Army in 1945. So it wasn't only the woo-woo psychic esoteric people that Russia got. They also got the V2 rocket scientists, just like the United States did, and the German Aviation Test Center scientists, right? And then the question becomes, because the United States brought a lot of those Project Paperclip Nazis into the United States over a span of a lot of years. I think that it was like, I believe over a span of like 10 years. Russia just went in and got them all in one lump sum. So they got the pick of the crop, right? So what the United States was getting were the leftovers and the ones that the Russians didn't even want. Right. If you have the first pick of the litter, you're not going to pick, you're going to pick the best of the best. Right. And whatever comes next gets the leftovers, which makes a lot of sense here, because the U.S. was bringing, I'm pretty sure that they brought them in the United States for over 14 years after World War II.
I wonder how that process.
And why didn't the Russians do that? Right?
How did that process go? I mean, if you're, does it just depend on who gets, who does the capturing, you know, because the Soviets were really taking a ton of obviously working their way back through across the Soviet Union towards Germany, coming in, taking as many Germans as they could. My guess would be that if you were a German and you had a deal to cut, you'd want to get taken by the Americans and not the Soviets, right? I mean, given what you had been doing, your team had been doing on the way into the Soviet Union, and knowing what the Soviets are doing to you on the way as they're chasing you back to Germany, they're going scorched earth. I mean, the last thing you'd want to do is say, oh, fine, you know, if I have my choice here, I don't want to go to the Soviet Union. I'd rather go work for you in America. You seem a little bit more reasonable. Do we have any indication as to how they did the draft? You know, I mean, were they go, you draft this guy first in the first round, and then we take, you know, in the second round, we take Wernher von Braun. I mean, how did that work? If Russia took them all at once, then they probably, you're right, they probably did get a real good, draft choice. They had a really good draft class of building rockets and things like that. And I forget what the program was called. Warsaw, I think. I thought it was like, not Warsaw Pact. That was like the antithesis of NATO, but it was, I thought it was the Warsaw something or other, which was like the Operation Warsaw or something. I'll have to look it up. But I know Russia was doing the same thing that we were thinking, which is we could put these guys up against the wall and shoot them, but they're so valuable. Like, why don't we just keep them and make them work for us? And like, why don't we, instead of shooting them, let's treat them well and see if they'll tell us what they know. Was that what the Soviet Union, was that their mentality with this as well?
Well, I mean, you think the war just ended. You probably assume that maybe the United States is going to just come in and possibly execute all of the former Nazi scientists and the Nazi engineers and all that. So I would think that maybe it was, let's just try and get anywhere that we can. Let's just get out of here, you know, into someplace safe. Now, I can't speak Russian, so I'm not going to attempt to butcher the name of this operation, but if you just type into Google Russian Project Paperclip, it'll give you the name. I just don't want to butcher it super bad. Now, the 6,500 Germans that were transported from former Nazi Germany was a little bit different than the United States Project Paperclip. The Germans that were transported were taken as war reparations. That's how Germany justified taking the German scientists and V2 rocket engineers and whoever else that they got. It was taken under the war reparations banner to the Soviet Union. And the operation was headed by Ivan Surov, probably butchering his name as well, but he rounded up the German scientists and then transported them by train to the USSR. So I'm sure that it has something to do with, let's get out of here as quick as possible. We don't know what the United States is actually, what their plan is or what they're going to do, and we need to get to someplace safe, which really begs the question of, why has Russia been the enemy since the Cold War, right? Are our Nazis at odds and at war with
Nazis,
another country's Nazis?
Well, listen, I mean, I know they say Germany lost World War II, but the Nazis didn't. They're in Bariloche, Argentina. They're in Washington, D.C. They're in Los Alamos. They're in Johnson Flight Center. I mean, we sprinkled them around. I mean, if it was something that had to do with aerospace or engineering or some sort of bio weapons, my guess is that you would see swastikas in there at some place. And of course, we know about the founding of NASA and their connections to the Third Reich. It's pretty overwhelming and scary. And of course, that also doesn't make me feel good about the whole UFO, space, extraterrestrial story. When you know that you have an underlying theme of this, the agency, you know, in the United States that went to the moon was, you know, run by Nazis, and you go, that's not good. That's never a good thing. But they're definitely this time they're telling the truth. I mean, they're definitely telling you the truth about everything. So it feels very, this whole topic for me is so frustrating because, you know, the government treats us like we're children, and they feel that, you know, we don't have security clearance to know what's really going on out there. There's that story of Gerald Ford telling George H.W. Bush that he wants to be read in on the UFO file. And Bush says, you don't have the clearance for it. And he's like, I'm the president. And he's like, I don't give a fuck who you are. You don't have the clearance for that stuff. We're 37 levels above you in clearance. You're nowhere. You're not even on the totem pole. You're the president. You think you know anything? You don't know anything. So all this stuff makes me very frustrated that it's in the hands of the worst people ever and I don't trust them, of course. And you know what they'll do with this information. You know that they'll use it at a future time to control us. And there's been a lot of predictive programming lately about UFOs, about aliens. And you know, as much as I'm interested in the topic, I'm really not excited to see what the general public does if we get in a situation where they do start to roll out some Project Bluebeam component where they say, well, let's do a dress rehearsal. Let's do a trial run in some city and see what happens. Let's see if we can freak people out. Let's put something in the sky that isn't real. Let's do a formation. Let's do the Phoenix lights. Let's fly something over Phoenix. Let's freak everybody out. Let's call them crazy afterwards. Send the mayor out there dressed like an alien or with an alien. I don't know if you saw that press conference. That guy later apologized. That mayor later apologized. He's like, I have to apologize. I saw it too. Like, you know, there were some weird things going on in the sky. I don't know what to tell you. So I don't know the whole thing.
But he was kind of coerced. He was kind of coerced, I had heard, into kind of making fun of the subject.
Oh, really? Yeah. But, yeah. Well,
from what people say, I don't know if that's true or not true, but definitely interesting.
Well, so, oh my God. So is this, I get the feeling there's another movie in your future that you're going to be making. Is this...
I would love to do a movie on this topic because there's so much to it and you can track it back so far and I would love to really get into it. But my next movie is going to be on Stanley Kubrick and The Shining and MK Ultra. Ooh. So I'm working toward getting to a UFO documentary and, you know, proving all the stuff and, you know, getting into its advanced military technology that these people are seeing. And then the three-letter organizations and the government is trying to cover it up by calling it aliens, which has been a huge common theme through this entire thing. And that's a big reason that nobody wants to really talk about this. So I really appreciate you bringing me on. I've been turned down by quite a few people because it's not fantastic. You know, it's not fantastical. It's not confirming what people want to believe about it. They don't want to believe that it's military technology. They don't want to believe that it's advanced military craft because that's not special. Like, that's not something extraordinary. Yeah. And when people find out that all of it is human craft, it destroys the community. It just does. People aren't going to be able to make thousands and thousands and possibly some people millions of dollars off of a phony, false, made-up narrative story that was basically implanted by NSA agents and Air Force special investigators, right? That doesn't make money. That's why none of these people that are popular in the UFO community will tell you any of the things that I told you today, because they might know, they might have an inkling, and they might realize that it has nothing to do with extraterrestrials or extraterrestrial craft, but they're never going to say it. And I've been seeing people starting to wise up to this phenomenon, and I'm really happy about that. And it makes me feel good. It makes me feel that, you know, I'm really making a difference on this topic, but it's not a popular thing to talk about. They're never going to invite me to a conference or anything to give a talk on this stuff, even though it's in-depth, detailed research that I've done, and it is, I feel personally, 100% the truth. Now, that doesn't mean that it's your truth. It doesn't mean that it's anybody else's that's listening to this is truth. I'm not trying to push what I believe on anybody else. I'm just trying to give you the facts and the data and the research based off of all these experiences and all the experiencers and all the events that have cemented this UFO lore and mythology into the consciousness of everyone. So that's really my goal. And another thing that I wanted to bring up really quick, I listened to Jeremy Corbell on and George Knapp on Joe Rogan. And Jeremy Corbell mentioned that he gets to a point within the intelligence community. Once you climb, this is what he says, right? Once you climb a ladder up so far and you talk to the people at the very top that actually knows about this stuff, Jeremy Corbell says that they aren't interested in disclosure. They don't want to disclose the information. Now, Jeremy Corbell says, and George Knapp comes on there and says, oh, well, it's probably because the extraterrestrials are feeding off of us, and we're like a prison planet, and we're like sheep, and we're cattle, and we're all this, and they're hurting us and all that, which that's a theory and a speculation that a lot of people have talked about. But not one time did they say, maybe they don't want to reveal this stuff because it's our stuff, because it's military technology. And if they reveal it and they come out and it turns out that it is, and I've been correct, and a few other people within the community that's been talking about this stuff has been correct, then that blows the whole thing wide open. Then that is when it becomes a national security threat that everyone has been talking about, because then all of the other countries know of the technology that we have. See, a lot of this stuff is huge misnomers and misdirections. It's not a national security threat because it's a threat of extraterrestrials. It's a national security threat because if other countries find out about it, it takes our defenses down. It's not a crash retrieval because someone seeing something fall out of the sky or saw it on radar or witnessed a craft falling from the sky. It can be something that was dug up. It could be an ancient technology from back thousands of years ago, right? That we have found in an archaeological dig that is now being called a crash retrieval. But when people hear the term and the word crash retrieval, they think of something right. Modern. They think of something that someone legitimately saw fall out of the sky, or something that they just found last week that's on the surface of the earth, when that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. See, they play with all of these words, and it's a misdirection and it's a misnomer. These words have multiple meanings, and people don't really think outside of the box. They just take those words like crash retrieval, like national security threat at face value, because they've been programmed to believe in extraterrestrials, and UFOs are extraterrestrials through government myths and disinformation.
On two different occasions, I've had a stealth bomber, the big ones, you know, I've had them fly over my head. And if I didn't know what it was, if I didn't know that it was ours, I would have thought it was, a UFO. I mean, I don't know, a B-2 stealth bomber is so large and so unbelievable. I was stopped at a stoplight. I had my sunroof open. I was in North Las Vegas. I was getting off work one day when I was selling homes out there, which is the community where I was 7 miles west of Nellis Air Force Base. And I'm stopped at a stoplight. I've got the sunroof open and I noticed like a shadow go over my head. And as soon as I look, I can see the tail end of it and it goes right over the front of my windshield, a huge bomber. And then I watch it bank and make a big left turn where it was coming in, because it was going to go land at Nellis. And as I was watching that, I was like freaking out. A second one went over. And I was like, oh my God, and the thing is massive. That was the second time I had seen it. The first time I saw it, I was out in the street in Pasadena after staying over with a friend, at a friend's house for New Year's Eve. We were there, it was New Year's Day in Pasadena. They have the Rose Bowl. And we were just out in the street that morning, just throwing the football around, me and a couple guys. And one went over the street where we were. And we were like, oh my God, that was in the 90s. That was in the early 90s when we saw that. And we were just like, what the fuck is that? Like, oh yeah. Oh, we just did the Iraq war, the first Iraq war. And that's when it became out of its classification status. And it was like now known that's what it was. But if I didn't know, if I didn't have TV or something, or if that had happened, if let's say I was at a lake in the middle of nowhere and one of those things flew over, I'd be like, UFO for sure. 100%. There's no other explanation. There's no engines on it. It's all black. It's as big as a city block. I mean, it's the biggest goddamn thing I've ever seen in the air. And it looks ominous. So, I mean, a stealth bomber is a UFO if you don't know it's a stealth bomber, right?
That's absolutely right. And I'm going to tell a story really quickly. It was in, I was in California and I was working the graveyard shift. And it was late one night. I was on the back patio of the place that I was working. And I had one of those really long laser pointers, one of those laser pointers that will shine like miles into the sky. And I was with my friend that I was working with at the time. And this was probably like, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. And I was like, and I saw a plane. The plane was spewing out chemtrails, right? And I was like, oh, I'm gonna get this guy, whatever. So I take out my laser pointer and I shine it at that plane. And I kid you not, 2 minutes later, a craft appeared probably 300 feet above the house that I was working at. It was almost dead silent. It didn't have any propellers and it was just hovering. And I'm like, holy shit, that's a military craft. And they pinpointed where I was shining that laser at the other aircraft, and they came through to see where it was coming from and you know, what was going on. And that was my first interaction with any sort of advanced military craft.
Yeah, they sent the quiet helicopter over to your house.
I didn't see a propeller. I mean, it was dark. I didn't see a propeller. It was kind of wide. It looked like it had two like engine thrusters on the back end of it. I don't think a helicopter is going to have engine thrusters. It's just going to have a propeller because it glowed at both ends of the craft, and it was just hovering, just hovered there. And I was like, wow,
laser.
They got the technology and they can pinpoint whoever's screwing with people. And I was like, damn, I'm glad nothing really came up. They probably figured out that it was just someone screwing with some kind of plane. But that plane definitely made a call in to the military.
Jeez.
And the military went out to investigate. And I was like, holy crap, like this is some advanced shit, because it literally just came out of nowhere, dude. Like, we were standing there, like, looking at the plane that I was shining the light at, and then all of a sudden, like, 2 minutes later, dude, this thing just appears, like, almost, like, off-center of the house, not very high in the sky either. And I was like, bro, what is that? And then we run inside real quick.
Well, man, look, I mean, it's a mysterious universe out there. There's a lot of stuff that we don't know. I'm open to hearing about a lot of this stuff. I'm also, you know, weary of a lot of scammers or grifters or people that claim to know more than they actually do. I just want to figure out where it all fits. You know, I'm not scared of UFOs or aliens or things like that. I'm open-minded. I'm interested. I'm ready to have the conversation. I'm an adult. I can handle it. Lay it on me. Talk to me. But the problem is the people that would be in a position to lay it on me are the people I don't trust. I don't trust the government. I don't trust the intelligence agencies. The ones that would have the information conveniently are the least trustworthy people on the planet. So convenient for them, I should say, not very convenient for us in the world that just wants answers. And I don't have any, I don't need the answers because I'm going to go do anything necessarily with it. I just want to know where I'm living. I want to know what this world is. I want to know what's real and what's not real. Listen, if it's the military doing this stuff, which I assume the bulk of it is, if not maybe all of it, then I get it. You keep stuff secret. But like, as things go on, you've got to declassify. You've got to let us know about some of this. I got to know what the X-37B is doing in space for 4 years. I want to know that. I know they're not going to tell us now because it's just went back up there, but I want to know what these things are doing. Like, you know, I'm just curious, and I know you are too. And I think that a lot of the people, even the ones that in the UFO community that get it wrong, I think a lot of them get into it wanting to get it right and then either fall into some of these traps or get caught up in being a big deal in the community. Like I'm a well-known ufologist or something. I've written 97 books about the topic. You know, I can't stop now. And then that becomes a grift. I mean, let's be honest at that point. But the people that I know that say, I saw something unexplainable, I don't know what to tell you what it is, I'm not making any money off of it, I don't need to do an interview about it, I'm just telling you I saw it and this is how I felt about it. For those people, I'm fascinated to know more about it. And I appreciate you coming on and giving us the details of you know, this. Like you said, it's 77 years. So it's been a long time. It's been long enough, man. If you're hiding this from the Soviet Union because you didn't want the big bad Russians to get you, we're past that shit. Or maybe we're not, if you ask Biden. But we should be past that stuff. And it's like, lay it on it. You know, there's part of me that goes, lay it on us. You know, we're adults. We can handle it. And then I turn on the news and I go, well, maybe we're not. You know, maybe not all of us are ready to handle it. Ryder, where's the best place for people to find you, to support your work, to get your shows, to watch the JFK movie? What's the best place?
Thanks so much for having me on, Charlie. Really appreciate your time and energy and effort and willing to have this conversation. You can find me on YouTube at Raised by Giants, on Rockfin and Raised by Giants, Odyssey, Rumble, any and all podcast platforms. And if you would like to watch my documentary, JFKX, it is on Amazon Prime. Just type in JFKX. If you are outside of the United States, unfortunately, you cannot purchase it on Amazon. But if you go to Vimeo.com, you can purchase the movie on Vimeo, and is also on Tubi. So if you live, I think in you can get it in Canada if you have Tubi, you can watch it for free with ads. And I think in Australia, I think Tubi's in Canada and Australia. And please support my movie and my film. We're working on the second one right now, and I have been told nothing confirmed, because you know how the community works, Charlie, and I'm not going to come out and say that this is true, but I have heard that a former president has seen JFKX and has confirmed it. So I'll leave you guys with that.
It's a wild. You and Jay did a great job on it, man. And I want to see that missing footage. I really do. You know, not the missing footage from your movie, but you know, the missing footage from their movie that they have that they don't want anybody.
Exactly. The cuts in the film.
They definitely doctored that. That's Ryder Lee, everybody. Go check out his stuff. Go support his work. My God, we're in the alternative media. Nobody's given us a hand here. So if you want to go check out his JFKX movie, please do go check it. And also subscribe to Raised by Giants. Get on his podcast. And if you like this episode, take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. You can connect with me through the website, macroaggressions.io. Thanks, everybody. I'll talk to you again soon.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.
Sally from Finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.